This is the Saturday Night Live Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at El Paseo Shopping Center, room 120 in San Jose, California, on February 21st, 1992. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Susan P., and the main speaker is Scotty M. from San Bruno. The original recording and its copy are at the Saturday Night Live Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Tonight is Susan P.
Hi, my name's Susan and I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's kind of funny. I was at work today and I was talking to a guy that I work with who knows that I'm in the program, but he's not an alcoholic. And he said, "What are you doing this weekend?" And I said, "I'm speaking at an AA meeting tonight, and I'm pretty nervous about it." And he said, "Well, how many people, And I said, "Anywhere from 2 to 250. I said, "But, the thing I'm nervous about is that they record it." And he said, "Well, why don't you just have a drink, and that'll calm your nerves, and you can go speak at this meeting." And I just kind of looked at him, and I said, you don't get it, do you? I'm really grateful to be able to say that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason why is because it wasn't so very long ago that I couldn't do that. I couldn't admit that. It was my biggest fear, and I couldn't admit that. And I can honestly say today that I love Alcoholics Anonymous with every molecule in my body, 9 days out of 10. And that, is that a sales job? No, it's not. And I'm going to try to briefly let you know why. I started drinking when I was only 8 years old, and by the time I was 10, I was drinking almost on a daily basis. I ran with an older crowd. My brother was older, and alcohol was very accessible for me. Both of my parents drank, but they weren't alcoholics, so I guess it's not their fault that I'm an alcoholic, but sometimes I wish it was. So I started drinking at a very early age, and by the time I was 15, I had encountered so many very intense problems due to my drinking that my life was already falling to pieces. I had been, kicked out of schools. My parents discovered that there was a problem, and they started putting me, in and out of drug rehabs, and I had been in and out of juvenile hall for, possession and drunk in public and those kind of things. And at 15 years old, I ended up landing myself into a mental hospital. And you know what? It was there, I think, it was the very first time that I can recall the feelings of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And I think one of the neatest things about this room is that anybody who's an alcoholic understands what that means without you even really having to explain it. I found myself in this mental hospital. I was, 15 years old. My family wanted nothing to do with me. I had no friends. I had a horrible track record behind me already, and I found myself stripped totally stripped, except for a straight jacket, on the floor of a padded cell, bawling my brains out, and I was embarrassed in front of myself. And to me, that's what pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization is when you're absolutely embarrassed in front of you alone. Upon leaving this place, I went to a boarding school for addicted teenagers, and I found out one thing, and that is that when you get 40 students that are all teenagers in one spot and they're all addicted, there's drugs and alcohol galore daily. And it was never a problem having access to drugs or alcohol. I graduated from high school somehow. I came back to San Jose. At 17 years old, I had traveled all over the country because of my drinking and my thumb, and had run away several times. And any document that you could look at, whether it was the medical records or the hospital records or the school records or anything like that, would tell you that I had a very destructive life and a very destructive pattern. And one thing that I remember more than anything else was my parents constantly saying, "We just want you to be normal." And constantly feeling inside, "I just want to be normal." And once I graduated from high school, any concept of normalcy that I had was gone. The easy life of high school was gone. The stress of having to, you know, try to conform to the society's wishes of going to college and that kind of thing, you know, that was never anything that really appealed to me. And what appealed to me was drinking. That's all that really appealed to me. I mentioned drugs, and I mentioned them for one reason only, and that's because I really don't feel like I'm an addict. My experience is, you know, I don't have any problem with addicts, but my experience was that, you know, in 1987, I went out one night and had an exorbitant amount of alcohol and smoked some pot that was laced with PCP, and totally blacked out. I don't remember the night, but when I woke up the next morning, there was vomit all over my bedroom. My car was crashed, my arm was broken, and I was black and blue from head to toe, and I couldn't have told you what had happened. I had no explanation. And that morning I said, that's it, I'm never doing drugs again. And I never did, but I hit the bottle harder than I had ever hit it in my entire life. That things like that kept happening to me. You know, I kept waking up with wrecked cars. I kept waking up with no boyfriend or with a new one or, you know, with no friends or some very strange friends. Or I, you know, things kept happening to me, and my self-esteem was getting lower and lower. The self-respect was long gone. My parents, nobody wanted to have anything to do with me. And in 1987, see, there's a neat little story here. Let me digress just a little bit. When I was 12 and I was drinking and smoking pot a lot, I lived up in Belmont, and my next-door neighbor had this boyfriend, and I used to go over there and babysit her kid all the time. But one day her boyfriend was there, and he had this little Zippo lighter, and it said AA on it. And I said, what's that? And he said, look it up in the phone book, Alcoholic Pride. So I looked it up in the phone book and saw Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked at him and I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, you'll figure it out when you grow up. And what he didn't know is I probably could have used it back then. But so now here I am, you know, 6 years later, it's 1987, and somehow or another, in the middle of all this madness, in the middle of losing everything, somewhere inside of myself I said, maybe I'm an alcoholic, and the name Alcoholics Anonymous came to me, and I knew that I could find them in the phone book. So I picked up the phone and I called Central Office, and the diverter line got me to this lady named Bev, and Bev's still in this program, and I'm really glad. And Bev talked to me for a couple of hours until it was time to go to a 6 o'clock meeting at Saturday Night Live, and I promised her that I'd be there, and God, I lived across the street. But I never made it because we hung up the phone, and I picked up the scotch, and that was that. And I didn't. Alcoholics Anonymous did not cross my mind again until 1989. 2 years it took me. It took me through going through a whole bunch of more horrifying experiences, and, you know, I wish I really had the time to stand up here and tell you about it. But it took me going through jobs and getting fired for drinking on the job. It took me through losing my family completely. It took me through getting cars repossessed, getting kicked out of houses and apartments, having my friends say, you're sick, get out of my life, I don't want to watch you die anymore. Having my, you know, I just had to lose everything. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous the very first day, I weighed a whopping 89 pounds, and I weigh 120 now. So, you know, I looked real sick. And my eyes were sunken into my head. My hair was falling out of my head because I had malnutrition. I had bleeding ulcers in my stomach. My kidneys were failing. I had liver damage. And I was a mess. You know, and my doctor, not only did my doctor tell me that she didn't think I'd see the end of the year, but she also told me that she wouldn't treat me because she couldn't stand the heartache of watching alcoholics die. And it scared me, and I remembered my conversation with Bev, and I remembered that there were meetings at this place. So I went to this place, and I spent a couple of weeks driving around the block. I mean, don't get me wrong. I didn't, like, walk in and go, okay, I'm wonderful, you know. I spent a couple of weeks driving around the block and being real scared. And when I finally walked into the room, you know, let me digress again. My family is kind of mixed religiously. My dad's very strict Roman Catholic. My mom's very strict Episcopalian. They divorced, and he married an Orthodox Jew, and she married a non-Orthodox Jew. And when I was 15, with all this religious confusion, I walked into a non-denominational Christian church and told the pastor I wanted to be baptized at 15 years old. And he wanted to talk to me about who I was and what I was all about. And when I finished telling him, he told me that at 15 years old, the nature and number of my sins was too great for God to forgive, and he wouldn't baptize me. So now it's my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walk in the door, and there's people praising the Lord and jumping up and down. And they're like sitting up, and then they form like this Congo line. And they're walking around this room singing praise God. Well, for those of you who don't know or don't remember, our old room was at the community center. And the room next door to our old room had a Sunday night revival meeting. And I walked into the wrong room. And I hot-tailed it out of there so fast it wasn't even funny. And I ran back to my car and I grabbed my bottle of scotch. And I finished it, and I was shaking, and I said, God, that could not have been the right room. Just go look one more time. And I walked around, and I walked in, and I said to this guy, this little, you know, and I don't see him anymore, and it makes me sad, because he's the first face that I saw in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's the first person that made me feel like I was a complete human being, you know, and he didn't even try to screw me. but I walked in, and I said, is this AA? And he said, yeah, come on in. Hey, everybody, we have a newcomer, you know, because they had just finished, and he wanted me to be able to stand up at my first meeting. And it was really embarrassing, and Jack Holt was chairing the meeting, and he called on me at my very first meeting, and I was drunk, and I don't even remember this the rest of that evening, but people who were there tell me that I just sat at the podium crying, don't let me die, I don't want to die anymore. And that's the way I was when I came in, and I spent 2 weeks shaking, hallucinating, throwing up in people's cars, and going through detox. And you know what? The sad thing about all that is that it wasn't enough, because I went through almost 8 months of sobriety in this room, dry and cracking. I didn't take any steps. I had 12 sponsors in 8 months. I didn't do anything. And the message, and I'm grateful for that experience now, because the message that I can carry to you is, you know what? If you don't do anything, you're not going to get anything. You know, it's like if nothing changes, nothing changes. And nothing had changed for me on the inside or outside. I wasn't willing to go to any lengths to get this program. And as a result, I had to go out and drink one more time. And within 60 days, the car was gone, the house was gone, the friends were gone. I couldn't bring myself to coming back in here because the pride was there. It was the only thing I had left, was my false pride. My family said, as long as you're drinking, we don't want anything to do with you. Everything was gone. One more time, the bottle was empty and nothing was left. It was taking me like 6 shots of scotch in the morning just to stop shaking enough to put mascara on. And at the end, you know, it's like I looked around me and I thought, wow, there's, you know, buckets of puke all over my room. I haven't had a shower in a month. You know, I know what I need. All I need to do is go out. So I got myself together and I went to a bar. I mean, it was, you know, the only thing I could think of. But I went to this bar and I sat down, and it was on May 4th. And it was a Mexican bar, and they were kind of pre-celebrating Cinco de Mayo, and Coronas were on the, you know, on the house, 75 cents a bottle or something like that. And I hated beer, but I was drinking beer, and these guys from AA came in that I knew, and they knew me, and they sat down at my table, and they asked me for my car keys, and I proceeded to get really, really, really drunk. And at 11:45 that night, I put down my last drink, and I said, will you take me to the midnight meeting? And I came into the midnight meeting literally crawling. I left the midnight meeting to throw up, and I don't remember. You know, I just woke up the next morning at a lady named Marty's house. And Marty was my first sponsor in this program, and she hung on to me, and she let me hang on to her. And that's when I started my journey of the steps. And you know, since that time, I've worked the steps to the best of my ability. I've had a couple of different sponsors, and I wouldn't change anything that I've done in my sobriety. And that's not to say that I haven't made mistakes, because I have. I've made big ones. But you know what? My sobriety is the most precious thing I have in my life. And because it's my belief that because I work these steps to the best of my ability, because I try, and I don't always succeed, but because I do try to apply the principles of the program into my life on a daily basis, my family has come back. I have friends. I mean, you guys are my friends, and you're my family. And, you know, there's days that I don't know what I'd do without you. You know, even on good days, I don't know what I'd do without you. This is my home group, and it's an honor to be asked to speak at a meeting at my home group. And it's an honor to look out there and to see a room full of faces of people that I love, that I know love me back. And you know what? That's a far cry from what it used to be. I have a job today that I absolutely love. I mean, I get excited about my job every time I get in the elevator, you know. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, both times I was unemployable, absolutely unemployable. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most ugly, disgusting, pathetic women I had ever seen in my life. And I don't think that of myself today. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my life was in shambles. I had no self-respect, no morals, no concept of what morals even were, and my life is not like that today. And that's not to say my life's wonderful. God knows there's things I'd change in my life today. But you know what? Because of the steps and because of you people, because of a God of my very own that I acquired, regardless of all the religious BS in my past, I've acquired this loving, forgiving, caring God that guides and directs me. And because of all of those things, because of working steps and trying to practice the principles, I feel a lot of peace on the inside. You know, I feel a lot of peace on the inside. I don't want to blow my brains out on a daily basis. I don't want to drink on a daily basis, you know, and I know it's time for me to sit down and shut up, but I just want to say one more thing, and that is, you know, there's a guy named Chuck C. He wrote a book called A New Pair of Glasses, and he says something in there that I think is just so wonderful. He says, what you're looking for, you're looking with, and that's been my experience. I was looking for friends. I was looking for a God. I was looking for peace. I was looking for all these things, and I found them all right within my heart, and you guys gave me the roadmap to find it. Thank you.
Scotty M. from San Bruno.
Hi, everybody. My name's Scotty. I am an alcoholic. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's nice to welcome all the newcomers. I really don't know. I haven't been able to figure out yet, you know, in a speaker meeting, how do you put 28 years of drinking and 30 years of being dry in 40 minutes? I haven't figured it yet. But I want to first of all, I want to let you know I'm not a speaker. I'm not a circus speaker. I don't call myself a speaker. I just get up here and talk, and I try to tell you what it was like and what happened. So I guess I'll get on to with what it was like and what happened and how little I changed. I was born in Scotland, and I think this part of my life and my story is interesting because it's, in later years when I tried to come into this program, I it had a lot of effect on me. I was born in Scotland, and my mother and one sister was born in Ireland, but we never claimed to be Irish, you know. And, we were British of Scottish descent. I never could figure it out, you know. And it was only until later that, you know, what's going on over in Ireland today. If you're Irish, you're a Catholic, and we were all going to Salvation Army. We're Protestants. We were not Irish. We were Scotch. And going to the Salvation Army, I left there when I was about 8 years old. And going to the Salvation Army, and, you know, you go to Sunday school and you hear all these things, you know. You get different conceptions of God. They talk about God. They talk about Jesus Christ. And they talk about Jonah and the whale. And you talk to some Catholics, and they're talking about the Pope. You know, pretty soon you don't know what to believe. But one of the things that stuck in my mind when I was very small, I had six sisters. I was next to the youngest. And one day I was in a bedroom, and I must have had one of my sister's dolls, if I can remember right. It used to amaze me how when you laid it down, the eyes closed. Yeah, I was about 4 or 5 years old, I guess, and it just amazed me. It just intrigued me, and I wanted to see how it worked. And next thing I know, I got that doll apart, you know, and standing there looking at it. And my mother walked in the room. And I said, uh-oh. And I stand there with a doll tore apart, and I figured, I'm going to get it now, you know. And she walked over to me, and she put her finger on my chest. It says, something in here tell you you're doing wrong? I thought a while. And I said, yeah. She said, do you know who that was talking to you? And I says, no. She says, that was God. You know. Now, do you know why you did it? I says, no. She says, well, that was the devil in you. You know. So, you know, and it was things like this that, you know, as far as, you know, and we had a big sign in our kitchen at every house, you know, and big red and white letters. And it said, Christ is the head of this house, the unseen guest at every meal, the silent listener to every conversation. And it seemed like every time I sat down to eat, that was over my head, you know. I was looking at it, and God, you lose your appetite, you know, reading something like that. So, anyhow, I came to this country when I was about 8 years old, and my first drunk, see, my father was the alcoholic. My mother never touched a drink in her life, never smoked, you know, I thought our family was dysfunctional, but I didn't know why. I never hardly knew my father because my mother and father separated when I was real young. I think about today, they're being dysfunctional because my mother would never lie. She never condemned or criticized anyone. I thought she was the one who's dysfunctional. But anyhow, we got here, and I never drank till I was in grammar school. I was about 12 years old. And I went and it was people's house, and they had a maid. You know, anyhow, they gave us, this was back in the early 30s, and they gave me a glass of wine. And I drank that. Got that glass down, and I sat there a little while. And, you know, we were brought up and taught, you know, to be seen and not heard. After that glass of wine, that went out the window. Jesus, what a feeling, you know. Felt so good, I wanted another one. And this matey was a mute, you know. And so I held up the glass of wine, you know, for another one. And she shook her head no. And I thought, well, what the hell, you know. She can't tell nobody. I saw the gallon of wine sitting on the kitchen table. I walked back into the kitchen. I didn't pour out a glass. I just picked up the gallon jug and drank it right out of the jug. You know. And I don't remember how I got home. But we're living on a ranch in Nevada, and it was summertime. Next morning, my mother's waking me up. We had two houses there on the ranch. And I lived with a chore boy and one of my sisters, and my mother lived in the other house. And she'd come over, and I was covered, laying on the bed in the summertime, hot, laying on the bed, and I threw up this wine all over me. And it stunk. It was all over my clothes, all over the bed, down my boots, everything. And I don't remember getting home. And it smelled like hell, you know. And my mother came in, come on, you better get up, cleaned up, and get something to eat. Okay. My mother was, I knew how she was about booze, you know. Being my father was the alcoholic, and she never touched it, you know. And she always used to say, you know, you'd be all right as long as you don't lift your little finger. And the deck of cards are never allowed in the house because they cause fights and arguments, you know. So I got up and got cleaned up and got dressed, and I was walking over to the other house. What am I going to tell her? I know how she's against booze, you know. So I don't know where it came from, but I went into the house, and she says, what happened? And I said, I ate a bowl of pickled beets because, you know, that's what I look like, you know, when she saw me. And She didn't say anything, you know, but the thing that I had to remember, the thing that I couldn't forget was I could never eat pickled beets in the house again, you know. I guess I was what you might call a social drinker. I got married when I was 18, and my wife and I were both 18, and between us we had 9 kids, 8 girls and a boy. We did other things besides drink. And I didn't have any trouble with the booze, you know. I didn't think I did. I spent a year and 9 months in the service on a destroyer. I was on this destroyer for about a year, and I never thought about it till actually until I got in the program. But I was on report. And the day I got on that destroyer, the day I got off of it, all due to drinking, you know, and blackouts. Oh, I never remembered anything, see. And the old man called me up, or the exec or the engineering officer, what happened? I said, I don't know. And I was telling the truth, I didn't know, you know. And they just shake their heads and walk away, you know. Well, you know, you're on report, and I said, yeah. Anyhow, my drinking didn't get serious until I went to work. I went to work for the newspapers in the city. I was living in the city, and I went to work for the, at that time, there was four newspapers. And then this was in 1951, I went to work for the newspapers, and you know, I never could understand why anybody drank in the daytime. I thought it was a waste of time and money to be drinking in the daytime, you know. Most of my drinking was Saturday night, because I spent all day Saturday with a hangover. You know, not feeling good, and waiting until like Mondays I'd go to work and get it over with. But along about 55, I guess it was, the drinking started in the daytime, you know. And it was, you know, waiting till 4 o'clock. You get to, couldn't wait till 4 o'clock to get out of there and go have a drink. And anyhow, the drinking progressed, and the one thing that bothered me a lot was the blackouts. I was working swing shift at the time, and I'd get off at 9 o'clock at night, and I'd be drunk on the job. So sometimes, you know, I mean, most of the time, I guess. And I'd go to cross street to the bar, close that up, you know. And I'd wake up about 3 or 4 in the morning. First thing I do is look out, where down's the car, you know. I was in the car, it's outside, it's okay. But I don't remember driving home. And I wonder, what did I do at work? I don't remember leaving the place. I get dressed, if I'm not already, jump in the car, go down to work. Everything is just like it's supposed to be, you know, but I don't remember a damn thing. Well, this gets annoying after a while, especially when it happens every night. And, you know, nothing I could do about it. The thought of giving up drinking never entered my mind, you know. I didn't think that had anything to do with anyhow. You know, if I could just find the right way to mix it or, you know, the right kind of drink, everything would be all right. But I still couldn't get rid of these blackouts, so I just quit the job. And they couldn't understand that. Well, I couldn't tell them, hey, you know, I can't work anymore. I'm suffering from blackouts, you know, and I can't stand it. You can't tell your boss that or anyone. So I just quit. And this was in 59 and bummed around a while. And now the drinking kept getting worse. And I have a sister, my oldest sister, my brother-in-law, were in the program. They came in about 1950. And I used to go to meetings with them, you know, I don't know why. I really didn't, because I had no intentions of stopping drinking. I just went to pacify them and get people off my back. And I never heard a damn thing. Wasn't interested. Wouldn't even say I was a visitor, let alone give them my right name. You know, the meetings are very small, and I remember going in there, it kind of reminded me of the Salvation Army, but they're all out of uniform. My drinking, like I say, was getting worse, and the wife was drinking with me, you know. And with all these kids, things are just beginning to be a problem. And so I was drunk, I guess, had to be, and I guess it might have been a Friday or Saturday night, but my two oldest sisters, my brother-in-law, my wife, they took me down to San Francisco General Hospital, and we're going to help you. I was almost Jenny agreeable. I hated any violence or arguments or fights. And I went down there, and I don't know, I don't remember anything about it. But I remember Monday morning I woke up and, I don't know, maybe about 6 o'clock and needed a drink. And I remember the bar down on San Bruno Avenue in the city there where I was living. The bartender there drank a shot in the beer like I did, you know. We used to like to talk, you know, carry on. So I went down there, you know, and sit there with him drinking a shot and a beer till about 11, you know, and feeling pretty good. And started getting tired, so I called a cab and came home, starting to go to bed, and knock on the door. I opened the door and there's two cops, two big Irish cops. I thought, what the hell is this about? You so-and-so? Yeah. Okay, come on, let's go. And I says, what for? He says, never mind, let's go. And, you know, I thought, well, Jesus, you know, my blackouts, maybe I, you know, but I wasn't driving the car. I don't like any violence of any kind. And I said, well, what for? You know, he says, never mind. He says, let's go, you know. And big Irish sergeant, you know. He looked like he'd been suffering from a hangover himself, you know. I looked at the wife, and the wife didn't say anything, you know. Well, I guess I better go. I'll find out later, you know. And I got in the car, and we headed downtown. I thought we were going down to the old Hall of Justice down on Kearney Street. Instead of that, they pulled up behind the San Francisco General Hospital. I thought, well, I guess they're stopping to pick up somebody in there, you know. I'm going to jail. So that they hauled me up to the 6th or 7th floor to the psycho ward. And you get in there and you get scrubbed down. They give you a pair of pajamas with the stocking feet in them, you know. And it's a great big ward, you know. And there's no beds in there. It's all cots. And you got about this much room between the cots. This place is full. Half a dozen white-coated tenants walking around trying to keep order in the damn place, you know. Well, it was fine because I was drunk when I went in there, you know. And I talked to a psychiatrist, and this guy was kind of young. And I says, "You're too young to be a." I started asking him all kinds of questions. I said, "You're too young to be a psychiatrist." Anyhow, the tenant says, "You that's your cot there." He says, "Now you get in it and stay in it unless you're going to the bathroom." I got in that and started watching around, you know, and LSD was popular. This is 1960. LSD was getting kind of popular, you know, and popular. And it wasn't unusual to see people walking around with piped in music, you know, and carrying on, you know. And then some of them would be going into DTs, and the rubber room was full, and they're sitting around in wheelchairs and straitjackets. This place is full. I thought, well, what the goddamn hell am I doing in here, you know? You talk about denial, Jesus Christ. So, anyhow, I had no money. You couldn't make a phone call. They took everything away from me, and I'm still wondering, what the hell am I doing here? So somebody said to me pretty soon, he says, why don't you go see the judge? And I says, what for? Well, he says, everybody goes to see the judge when you're in here. Oh, no. I'm wondering what the goddamn hell did I do now? See the judge. So I said, well, where's the courthouse? What courthouse? Where's the courtroom? Oh, he said, we have the court right up here on the ward. We used to go down to the courthouse, but they raised too much hell down there, you know. So now the judge comes here and we have court up here. Is this about the third day, I guess it was, isn't it? Bunch of them come walking in the room, and the judge is there with them, and the guy's got a clipboard, you know. The judge is a little guy about my size, and he's got my record there, you know. And he says, oh, he says, I see you got a big family. And I says, yeah. He says, I think you need help. And I says, yeah, good. He says, turn to the clerk. He says, Napa. Yeah. So the next thing you know, they give me a shot of paraldehyde. And that loaded me into a station wagon, a few others, and go up the highway and pull up to this big gate, you know. I'm going to go in the gate and I look up on the sign. It says, Napa State Insane Asylum. I thought, oh, God damn it. So the first, when you first go in, everybody goes into a receiving ward until they figure out, you know, what you are, what you're doing. All the rest of it. And I talked to another psychiatrist. He seemed worse than the other one. And so I figured, well, I just better, you know, stay here and ride it out. I was too ashamed. I don't know what it was. Denial, I guess. I didn't want to look at reality. And so anyhow, I stayed there that month, the 28 days there. And one day the called the names, a bunch of us in there, you know. And we were a mixture there in this receiving ward. They had everything in there. If you're real violent, they had a lockup ward for you, you know. But they just rang a bell, and attendants come and got you. Or they'd give you a shot, and they'd give you a sleep for 2 minutes. And anyhow, they called a bunch of names and come down the room, so-and-so. I went down there, and there's an attendant in there, and he's sitting there with a needle giving us shots, you know. And I never got into drugs other than alcohol. I mean, that was enough, really. And I says, "What's this for? You know, you want to give me the shot?" And he says, "What are you in here for?" And I was telling him, "I don't know." He says, "Well," he says, "we only have two kinds of people in here." He's not the mentally ill and the alcoholic now. He says, "Which one are you?" I said, "Oh," I said, "I'm an alcoholic." I could have qualified for both of them. But anyhow, I stayed there, and there was one guy that was in there for his 12th time. He was a merchant seaman. And his excuse was that he went on a trip, and he's a chief engineer in a merchant marine. He went on a trip, forgot to take the book with him. He was after me to go to meetings all the time, see. And the reason I was hanging around him, he had tailor-made cigarettes. And he played peanut on. So he kept after me to go to meetings. And I thought, well, I'll get this guy off my back. You know, I was always searching for a definition of alcohol that I could use and get you off my back. See, I used to ask all the doctors and psychiatrists, and I thought, well, I'll give it to this guy. And I said, what's your definition of alcohol? He says, I'll give it to you in three simple words. He says, now, don't you ever forget it. He says, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And, you know, I couldn't argue with him. He just stunned me with that, you know. So the first meeting we went to, and I went for the coffee and the cigarettes and the cookies. And I didn't hear a goddamn thing. Didn't want to. It was denial and contempt prior to investigation. I was full of it. And I thought, well, it wasn't too bad, but, you know. But to keep, you know, on the good side of him, I went the next week. As a matter of fact, that was the last week I was there. Prior to that, well, they just didn't have any. They had H&I meetings, you know, is when they could get there. Today, you know, you people are very fortunate that you have so many meetings and so many houses and places that you can get help, you know. And group therapy at that nut house was to go out in the hall and talk to your committee. But this last meeting I went to, and it kind of helped me, you know, because this guy that spoke that night at that meeting had been there committed there 23 times. And the commitment in those days was anywhere up to a year. And every time you went back there, you keep going back, the punishment gets worse. That was the treatment, punishment. They didn't want to see you again. His last punishment or treatment when he got there the last time was cleaning out the incinerator where they cremated the old people. And he talked about it and laughed about it. You know, I thought, my God, how could this guy, you know, want to come back here after all that kind of treatment? You know, but that was the program, but I couldn't see it at that time. Anyhow, I came out of there and went to one meeting a week down at Waterford. Came home from a meeting one night and walked in the front room. My wife was sitting there drunk as a skunk. And I thought, you bitch, how could the hell could you do this to me? You know, shit, after all I've been through, you know, I'll fix you. Yeah. I'm going to get me a shot in the beer. And I got in the car. And this is after, just after leaving the meeting, you know. And, you know, knowing all this that I've been through, you know. But I knew, you know, something was telling me it was, you know, it wasn't right. And, you know, the more I thought about it, I said, well, I'm just going to have one shot in the beer, you know. And I sat out in front of the bar, thinking about it some more. I said, well, as long as I'm just going to have one, I might as well make it a double shot in the beer, you know. And, of course, I closed the place up. And that was the start of a 2-year drunk, planned, bought, and played for without leaving my front room. My kids ended up in foster homes. What happened was I inherited some money, you know, and there's nothing worse than an alcoholic and his chips, you know, inheriting some money. You know. Oh, Christ. And and not to worry about blackouts, just don't leave the front room. You know, have the booze delivered, you know. Don't answer the door, don't answer the phone. Never had it so good, you know. I had a brand new 20-inch black and white TV, you know. I could sit there, and it was fantasy. It was fantasy. It was anything but reality, you know. I was in a world. I could watch a baseball game, and I was the guy throwing the ball, the guy catching it, and the guy hitting it. And I was beginning to think I was some kind of a genius. I could watch all these quiz shows. I knew all the answers, you know. Watching reruns, you're bound to. And, you know, depending on what I was drinking, that old black and white TV was in living color sometimes, you know. And this went on. Like I say, I had it planned for 2 years. And then, you know, when the 2 years was up and my money ran out, I was just going to go up and go back to work. Just that easy. But along about, I'd say about a year into this, the dry heaves and shaking and sweating, see. I never had a hangover because I never got sober. Wake up, maintenance drinking, just stay drunk. How can you get a hangover if you stay drunk? But I sure suffered the goddamn shakes and sweats and the dry heaves. And boy, yeah, that was killing. My heart would pound. I'm standing in my shorts sometimes and over the sink and sweat running off. This is in the later part of the year, you know, it's cold. And I stand over that sink with a bottle in my hand, make all kinds of deals to God. You just get me over this and I'll never drink again. Say this over and over, over and over. And it started to worry me because I was afraid it was going to, you know, start throwing up blood. You know, a couple of friends of mine had died that way. And what we used to do for him, we'd keep the bathtub half full. And when he started hemorrhaging and raising hell and bleeding, we just throw him in the tub. Clothes and all, there ain't no difference. Throw him in there. Well, that's where they found him one day. But now I was beginning to worry because I didn't want this to happen to me. There was one thing that I didn't want to die, you know, especially that kind of a death. And what came into my mind was that I was living to drink and drinking to live, and I couldn't do anything about it. This is a hell of a note to be in. I solved the blackout problem by just not leaving the house, but I couldn't solve this. The dry heaves, the shakes, and the sweats until I could get one to stay down. And sometimes it was hell trying to get one to stay down. Then I was worried about throwing up blood. So, you know, the alcoholic mind can really get to thinking when you want to drink. So when I called up the chairman to deliver my bottle, I just said, bring me a large can of tomato juice, because I was drinking a shot in the beer chaser. And I put the tomato juice in the beer chaser, you know. And if anything red came up, it wasn't blood, it was tomato juice. You know? I knew I couldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't do anything about it either. So, like I say, you know, it was getting pretty bad. You know, I was getting scared. I didn't want to die this way, you know, and here I am with that bottle in my hand making all kinds of deals with God, but never really being honest with him. Because as soon as I get one to stay down, I'd sit down, finish the bottle, do it all over again. But one morning, after I got all through, even in the dry sweats and shakes and all that, my heart pounding, finally got one to stay down. I sat down at the kitchen table to warm it, you know, and kept drinking and drinking and drinking, and nothing was happening. I wasn't getting any effect out of it at all, you know. And my wife had been gone for about 3 or 4 days, you know. I didn't even know where the hell she was or what she was doing. You know, wasn't really interested either. But pretty soon the front door opened, and here she walked in with my sister and brother-in-law. And she went into the bedroom, and I said to my sister, Jean, I says, what is she up to? And Jean says, oh, they lived in Millbrae, and Jean says, oh, she come down to stay with us. She's trying to get well. I said, oh, well, I didn't believe him, you know. And now Gus had been so, as far as I knew, had been in the program since 1950. But I never believed that this man was sober, because he was so bad. When he was drinking, they wouldn't take him into the hospital. They said there was no hope for him. He'd never get sober, never be sober. There was no cure, no help. They didn't want him in the hospital. So I couldn't visualize, you know, Gus as being sober. I knew my sister Jean was, because I knew what she was like when she was drinking. She was holy terror. So I'm sitting there, and my wife got some clothes together and put them in a suitcase, and I said, where's she going now? She's going down to the Millbrae. She's going to stay with us, get well. I didn't believe her. She says, if you don't believe me, she could see that, you know, that I didn't believe him. She says, if you don't believe me, come down and see for yourself. And I'm sitting there at the table, and I'm thinking about it, you know. And I'm looking at the bottle of whiskey on the table, a fifth of whiskey. But she said, if you come down, you're not bringing that bottle with you. Well, I knew goddamn well they were drinking that. They just didn't want me down there, you know. So I says, okay. So I went. I don't think I even took any clothes with me or anything. I just went with them the way it was and stayed with them. The first 30 days, I'll tell you the truth, I went to a few meetings, hated it, very, very sick, still couldn't keep anything down, slept on the sofa in my underwear, you know, and I used to take the pillow at night and turn it over and trying to find a cold spot, you know. The booze that was in me was just had me on fire. So a few meetings that we went to, in those days you only had discussion meetings, speaker meeting, and a beginner's meeting. That was it. There was no step meetings, there was no big book meetings, no AC, none of that stuff. So I go to these meetings, and God, I'll tell you, I wasn't listening. I didn't want any part of it. I didn't want to be there, you know. I was actually really wanting to hear somebody talk about how they learn how to drink without getting sick. I'd listen for that, you know. Nobody was talking about that. And, you know, they're all, you know, driving on the bridge wrong way and making U-turns and hitting, you know, all this crazy. I never got arrested. I never been in jail. I just figured I didn't belong here, you know. And I said to my brother-in-law, Gus, I says, isn't there any other kind of meeting than this kind, you know? He says, yeah. He says, maybe next Saturday night. This is 2 days before Christmas. He says, maybe next Saturday night we'll go to a speaker meeting. I said, oh, well, I didn't know what the hell it was. And I noticed all the meetings at that time were held in churches because nobody else would have you. You know, they wouldn't rent nothing to you. Hell, had to be an empty store that nobody wanted or something. So we went to this St. Matthew's Church in San Mateo, Episcopal Church, and went in there. And at that time, it was in the church. Today, it's in the hall next to the church. And there wasn't half as many people, not even half as many people as there are in here. And this was a speaker meeting, big speaker meeting, all groups. And as we walked in the door, there was a woman sitting there. By the door, a card table, or selling raffle tickets, you know. And believe me, my mind was really, really bad. I mean, mean. I am really just dry, believe me. Very sick. And walked in and I looked around and said, well, you know, I used to wonder, you know, how in the hell is this outfit making any money at a dollar a head? There's something wrong here. There has to be a gimmick, you know. So here comes the card table with the raffle tickets. And I said, well, I guess that's part of the act, you know. So I bought some raffle tickets and went in and sat down. And I'm looking around, and my wife is Catholic and my brother-in-law is Catholic. And my sister and I both were brought up in the Salvation Army. But I saw this priest walking around, and I thought he was, I wasn't sure, but he looked like a priest. And I said to my wife, I says, is that a priest, a Catholic priest? She says, yeah, I think so. I said, well, what the hell's he doing in here? She says, I don't know. So I look over to Gus, you know, and I said to Gus, I said, is that a Catholic priest? He says, yeah, I think that's Father John. He's going to give the pitch here tonight. I got a resentment right away, you know. You know, I already gave him a dollar for the damn raffle, and I had to put a dollar in for the basket when they pass that around, and no doubt they'll pass one for his church. But that isn't as bad as now I got to sit and listen to a lecture on drinking and sin, you know. So I had a resentment before he even got started. I sat down, and he was up at the podium, and he says, my name is Father John, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said to myself, that man's a liar. God wouldn't let that happen to him. He's too close to God. You know, I really thought the Catholic religion was at the top of the line, see? Because I knew the pain and suffering of an alcoholic. Yeah, I knew that, you know. Well, God would never let that happen to him. And he went on with his story, you know, and he'd tell a little bit about himself, and then he'd talk about me for a while. You know. And I said to myself, where in the goddamn hell did he hear about me? You know, I'm not even Irish. I'm not even Catholic. You know. And he'd go on, and then he'd talk a little more about himself, then he'd talk about me again. And I was really getting resentful. And I says, well, I'll just wait, and I'll catch him in a lie, you know. So he went on, and he said he'd been a priest for 12 years, and he professed to know God, but he had to come to AA to understand God. I said, oh, boy, if the Pope heard him talking like that. but there was something, you know, I couldn't identify with his drinking. He drank wine. I didn't like wine. But I could identify with all of his feelings. And I said to myself, well, if that man's an alcoholic, I have to be. He just told my story. And I was sitting there, and Jesus, you know, a big load came off of my shoulders. You know, just, I thought like I could have floated outside the doors on that in that church, you know. And the next thing you know, they're calling out the numbers on the raffle tickets. And I said, what'd you do with them tickets? And I put them in my pocket, and I look at it, and they're calling my number. And I won the big book. See? Now, I had no intentions ever of reading that book. No way. You know, because my brother-in-law, Gus, I had a resentment against him, you know. I used to blame him for my wife, for my sister's drinking, you know. And he read the book every day, you know. And I used to say to him, why do you read that book every day? He said, because it's a way of life. I said, what do you mean a way of life? He says, a spiritual way of life, God's way of life. You know. Well, this God part, you know, it's hard to admit that you're powerless, you know. And, you know, but if you don't, you think you're not powerless, go out and stop the rain or the wind when it's blowing, you know. It's just about the same thing. And I would never, you know, this man ended up being my sponsor. You know, and I think he was the one that invented tough love. God. Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I asked him, I says, how does this program work? He's very simple, he says, very simple. That's what he means. He says, well, don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. I said, I never got drunk on the first drink. He said, I told you you wouldn't understand it. Real simple. So, anyhow, I kept going to meetings around there. And after about 2.5 years, the wife one day, we both came in together and we both were dry. And one day, I don't know what happened, but it was, what was on her mind or what, but she picked up a can of beer. And that was the start of a 10-year drunk for her, you know. And I mean, I'm telling you that at that time, this program had done so much for me, you know. It really had. And God, and I wanted her to have it, you know, to have this program. But this is not for people who want it. Who need it is for people who want it. And I guess she didn't want it, I don't know what, but I tried and tried and tried. I think about the only thing I didn't do was kill her. But only one day, you know, the whole day long, she just terrorized me. I mean, she was in and out of hospitals and halfway houses and got drunk in them, you know, and, oh, Christ, jails, you name it. Didn't make any difference. And I was really sincere, and I wanted to give her this program and help her, you know. And finally, one day, I went down to see Gus. And I met him down there, and we walked out on the lawn. I'm telling him all about the wife, you know, what's going on, and my tale of woe and all this shit, you know. And I finally asked this to him. I said, Jesus Christ, I said, I don't know, what am I going to do with her? He looked at me, and he said, hey, he says, who do you think you are, God? He says, there is a God, but it isn't you. And I'll tell you, I've never forgotten that. It really told me, you know, like it says in the steps, how it really let me know how powerless I was. I couldn't stop drinking on my own, no way. Yeah. But God could and would if he saw it. And I was seeking God when I asked for help, but I wasn't really, you know, feel honest about it. And one of the things that kept me out of this program, in a way, you know, when I came here, it was a desire. You know, today it's a desire to stop drinking, but in those days it was an honest desire to stop drinking. And I didn't have an honest desire to stop drinking, so I really didn't think I belonged here. You know? And one of the things I've also learned, this program has taught me, is like being on a submarine for 3 or 4 years. I was on the submarine, not in it. And when that submarine goes down, you know, you go down with it, see? You're not safe anymore. But you get inside that submarine or get in this program, and you'll feel that safety. Anyhow, you know, it keeps telling you more and more will be revealed. And I'm going to end it up with this little story that kind of, you know, brings memories back to me. And this woman was working in the priest home. And she'd go there, and the priest had a parrot who would sit in the cage and sit there and say the rosary and pray. And all day long, just sit in the cage and pray, you know. And the woman said to the priest, she says, I have a parrot. She says, my parrot sings and talks and whistles. She says, all your parrot does is sit there and pray. He says, yeah. She says, do you mind if I bring my parrot over, put it in with yours for a while, see what happens? Says, yeah, sure. He says, bring it over. So she brought her parrot over, put it in the cage, and jumped up on the perch next to the other one. And the parrot says, hi, fella. My name's Loretta, and I'm a prostitute. He says, well, thank God, my prayers have finally been answered.